Good morning, good morning, and good morning to you too. Don't let me be misunderstood when I say that there is a tsunami taking place that is taking place in order for this country to actually come to a reckoning. And we're all a part of it because we're all here. What I like to say in this new season, as we go into the fall of the year, and for many of us, the fall of our lives, the season in which we can contemplate what we've done in the spring and the summer. And that's what this country is doing right now, or should be doing. In the fall of its history, it should be contemplating what it did during that young springtime when anything goes, when land was taken from those who were indigenous here, when people were kidnapped, worked by force of law and death on that land to create the country we have today, where many people who were immigrants to this country were denied full citizenship, where we had a Chinese Exclusion Act that prevented the Chinese Americans from having full citizenship. I want us to understand that every nation has its ugly side. In the spring of its, in its spring of its reckoning, it did things for the sake of power, for the sake of survival, for the sake of what it thought was expediency at the time. Personalities, charisma, the vision of one leader led to the Trail of Tears for Native Americans, their land taken away, even though cases went to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia Act. Yet those Native Americans in Georgia and many places were walked to Oklahoma, where we had the kill the Indian, save the man motto of stealing babies from their families. Native American children were forced into boarding schools in order to strip them of their culture, hoping that that would then assimilate them back into American society, American white society, and make them acceptable. We need to understand in the spring of this country, when it feared it would not survive, it did things to people. It did things. And then in the summer, when it decided, oh, the joy of what it possessed to be a nation among nations, one that had this amazing economy, one that people fought to be in, this nation among nations that it used as propagandist PR platform to send to the world that it was a nation of liberty and justice for all. In the summer of its growing, in its stability now as a world power, in the summer of the United States of America, when it had so much in its coffers, enough even to share with other nations on occasion. But that springtime heinous act, that time in its youth, the raping and murder, when it was trying to find itself, perhaps, that does not go away. The stain of it remains. It has not been reconciled as we go into the fall. In the fall of this country, and I mean fall of the season, and perhaps fall of its empire status, who knows? But what I am saying is all of these things were done, and history shows they have been done. And those brave people who spoke up in the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s, the 1900s, they left the breadcrumbs, boulder sized breadcrumbs, leading up to where we are today. And the response is for many of these people to say, no, we are not going to look at what we did in our youth. That was a long time ago. We don't want to be tainted with that. too many people as they're going into this next phase, this next season of this country, are looking back and fearful of what their grandchildren and their legacy will find and be. That is my concern as we ban books. That is my concern because the silence that many people of color were forced into was a silence based on death. I was asked at a speaking engagement last year, why is it all of these things are coming up now? Where have they been? And I was one of maybe five or six people of color in the room. And I said, don't you understand your own history? And that's what I think is the concern here. And for many of my listeners right now, who are white Americans or who are people from other countries? As I've had some people say, why do African Americans complain so much? Why are they so edgy? I have seen with my own eyes what this country has done to crush people who oppose or speak up about the brutality and the racism and all the other isms here. But I've lived to see it up to this point. I've been blessed with that. A generation ago, generations ago, someone speaking up saying the hanging body in the tree that's been lynched, do you know they have to pass by that body and go to school, go to work, go clean the homes of the people who participated in the lynching of the assaults, of the rapes, of the burning down of people's homes, the stealing of their land, the African Americans who had farmland stolen from them had to just leave or they would be murdered. That is the history of this nation in those books they want to ban. And what really gets me is most of these books are fiction. So these are fictionalized versions in addition to the nonfiction books, meaning you can't even take a story in which the depiction of what actually happened is written about in a fictionalized version. This is where we are in this country, afraid of what transpired in the youth, that spring of grabbing land and stealing people, rape and murder, avarice, greed. What it took to build this country is what needs to be faced. A truth and reconciliation commission. And I'm not talking about one, and this country has had many, many commissions. Every time there's a race riot of some kind where blacks or other people are attacked, there's a commission. And then what happens? They have like these wonderful documents, reports, and then afterwards they're chucked away somewhere in the libraries. One of the things that I wrote about in a Newsweek article that you could see as an op-ed article piece on President Biden signing an executive order making Emmett Till's, some of the Emmett Till's markers federal landmarks. Why? Because when they were private landmarks, when they were state landmarks, they were desecrated constantly. People would come and tear them down, shoot at them, take pictures destroying them in Mississippi. Emmett Till, the 14-year-old, not the young man, and I'm tired of people calling him a young man. He had just turned 14 a few months before he was murdered based on a false accusation by Carolyn Bryant. I wrote a play. You can see it. Go online, Dreams of Emmett Till. Please go watch my play. It's free. Dreams of Emmett Till. Very well done. This was done during the pandemic. Dreams of Emmett Till. And so I think of this, the silence. I refuse to be forced back into the silence. We had to pass the hanging bodies, ignore the abuse, the assaults, the shame and torture and torment in silence for generation after generation after generation after generation until now, where we can speak up loud and proud about what this country did in shame. I refuse to be silent. We should oppose these book bans again and again, wherever they are, because all they want to do is force us back into the silence. Going to take a quick musical break. Our guest today is amazing. Marcus Baram is a reporter with ProPublico. And what I want to tell you is that wage theft, the stealing of the wages of employees here in this state, is rampant. And we are on the cutting edge. This is a story just coming out today, and we have him on our show. He's going to talk about wage theft. You need to call your neighbors, call your friends, call the people who you know have been having their wages stolen, especially at these restaurants and some hospitals. Call them right now. Get them on the line so that they can hear what he has to say, how to file a complaint against this, how to have your rights respected, how to speak up. If you don't speak up, this country will roll right over you. We'll be right back after this musical break with Marcus Baram.
Hi.
So we are back. That was Maceo Parker, Children's World, and I am excited. As I said in my monologue, if you are quiet, then your rights will not be respected. It's not an automatic thing. Just because this is the most litigious country in the world with more laws than any other nation on the planet does not mean those laws will always just automatically protect you. So for those workers, and we all are in some aspect, whether or not we have our own businesses or we work for someone else, we need to know that there's such a thing as wage theft. And the person with us today, Marcus Baram, is going to help us better understand what is going on with this wage theft in New York State. And this is a cutting edge story just out today. Good morning, Marcus Baram.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's start where we can. We have people who are listening right now, who are retired, people who are working, people who are related to those people who are working, all different levels of jobs. When we're talking about wage theft, and I just want to know, what does that mean? What wages are we talking about, and where is this happening?
Yeah, it's a great question, because it's one of those things, when I started talking about working on this story with friends and neighbors, half of them had to have me define the term. Because I think people in professional, you know, white collar type professions and careers aren't familiar with wage theft. You know, if you're paid $1,986 every 2 weeks instead of $2,000, you would march into HR and say, hey, what's going on here? Something's wrong on my check. So people aren't used to that. But in low-income industries, especially restaurants, construction work, nail salons, car washes, it's pervasive. And what it means is that you are, you know, you have a certain pay that your boss has told you they'll pay you, whether it's, you know, obviously minimum wage legally, or higher that you've agreed to with your boss, and then they pay you less. So on a construction site, they might, you know, promise you $500 a week for your work, and then they end up paying you $400 or $450. And in some cases, like in restaurants, it works through tip garnishing, where obviously restaurant workers depend on tips for a substantial part of their wages. And the tips might be shared. Your tips might be garnished by managers and others at the restaurant. That's very common. Like it, even at fancy restaurants, like Per Se, one of the, you know, best restaurants of the country on the upper in Midtown, it has, you know, tasting menus up to $1,000. They got busted for $500,000 in wage theft a few years ago, mainly for tip garnishing. So that's basically what it means, is that your employer is cheating you out of your wages. That's wage theft.
And so the person, if they're going to be, as you said, not a white collar job probably, but a job in which the wages might be under the table, or they're being paid in cash.
That could be.
So how right. does, how that does then, if the person is negotiating a wage and that person's wage is then being shorted, how do they document that?
That's a good question. It can be difficult. I mean, if it's obviously under the table, it's very difficult to do. I mean, in general, I mean, most of the cases that are presented tend to involve pay stubs and paychecks. And so what they'll show is they will, you know, present their, whether it's their bank account or their paycheck in some cases, and show the discrepancy between what that, the posting for that salary, if there's a posting, or there might be a discrepancy between the pay stub that in the records maintained by the employer with the employee's own, you know, bank account and their own record of deposits and paychecks in some cases. But that can be difficult. It can be very difficult for the Department of Labor to investigate such claims when it's under the table, obviously involving cash, or whether it involves such discrepancies involving paychecks versus, you know, what the company is recording in their books. That can be tough.
So you've been a reporter at the New York Daily News and ABC News, as well as the New Yorker, the New York Times, New York Magazine, Fortune Magazine. You had a fellowship with McGraw, a fellowship for business journalism. You've been on the white collar side of employment. So what brought you to this issue of wage theft for the regular little guy?
I mean, actually, it came about through that McGraw fellowship, which involved covering overtime wage. And as some people might know, overtime wage rule, which basically as, you know, what they call time and a half. If you work more than 40 hours a week, you're entitled to be paid time and a half. And that federal rule, which has been around since the New Deal era, has been steadily eroded over the years. And so back in the late 70s, something like 65% or 63% of American workers qualified for overtime, full-time salaried workers. And that number has precipitously declined to 15% today. And that's for a number of reasons, mainly because a lot of corporate interests have lobbied to narrow the definition of who qualifies for overtime wages. And so that story hadn't really been told. And so I wrote four stories as part of a series about the erosion of overtime wages in America. And as a part, as a result of that, I, you know, was invited to, by Documented New York, great news outlet here in the city, to be part of this project in getting this database that they had obtained from the Department of Labor of wage theft violations, and working with ProPublica for a year through their local reporting network to investigate the pervasiveness of wage theft in the state.
So I know that some listeners are saying, wait a minute, what is the standard for overtime? Go through that one more time.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, the rule is, and this is very common and most people are familiar with this, is that if you work more than 40 hours a week and you have a full-time salary job, you're entitled to time and a half. You're paid basically, you know, 1.5 times your hourly rate for those hours beyond the 40 hours. And back in 1975, 63% of full-time salaried American workers qualified for overtime. And as of today, 15% of salaried full-time workers in America qualify for overtime. So the pool has shrunk, and that means that tens of millions of Americans have missed out on being paid for overtime, for working more than 40 hours a week. And as we all know, you know, many Americans work more than 40 hours a week, beyond 50 hours a week. And so that is a big kind of crisis, I would call it, that really hasn't been discussed and addressed. And actually right now, the Biden administration is on the verge of increasing the salary threshold. So basically with overtime, anybody who makes below a certain salary qualified for overtime. If you make above a certain salary, you don't qualify for overtime. And right now the threshold is, I believe it's about 47,000, might be a little lower. And for a long time, it was stuck at 23,000. And until 2004, it was actually even lower. It was something in the 10,000s, which meant that, you know, the majority of Americans didn't qualify for overtime. So, I mean, it's you know, there's a lot of different layers to it, but in essence, you know, many Americans have been denied the right to overtime for working overtime. So.
But we also have in this gig economy for women and men who, and women in particular, who are the majority of these gig workers, working two or three jobs because they only have work up to 25 hours or 30 hours. So they're never right. going to work the 40 hours so they can qualify for these other benefits.
Right, right. That's one of the ways that I think a lot of workers have missed out on overtime is due to that, because they're working multiple jobs. In other cases, there's a managerial exemption, which can be very, very exploited by employers. Like, for example, Dollar General, you know, that huge chain that dominates the country. And they're staffed by maybe two people in the entire store. And the guy who's the manager is also the one who's sweeping the floors, stocking the shelves, doing all the work. And because they're considered a manager, they're exempt from overtime, even though they're doing 90% of their work is like doing labor, physical labor. So there's a lot of different ways that, I call it like death by a thousand cuts, that overtime has been eroded over the years, which is really, you know, a problem.
So this is also a story that hit the news today. So I'm very excited that you're here on the Cutting Edge and this morning, and our listeners are getting something that's going to be all around us soon. Look for it for the rest of the day, but you're getting it here on WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. ProPublica has broken many stories recently. They are a major nonprofit news organization. But this one in particular is of concern to so many people, because we're all in some form, if we're not independently wealthy, and even many people independently wealthy are still working, but they don't need the money. We are trying to not just balance out these many different jobs that we have, but figure out how to pay our bills in the meantime. What you're saying for a place like Dollar General and for smaller places, say restaurants, I noticed in the story when I read it that the restaurants are doing this when it comes to tips. that people who are relying on tips in restaurants or busboys and, you know, other people who are washing dishes, et cetera, are in a situation in which they are being shorted. But they're also, some of them here, as undocumented.
Right, right. I mean, restaurants is one of the main industries in which wage theft is common and is rampant. And I think part of that is due to the fact that there is a discrepancy between the tipped wage and the minimum wage. And so the tipped wage is $10 an hour for waiters, busboys, et cetera. And obviously minimum wage is $15. And so that discrepancy, if you're in your shift, you make less, then it's a slow, you know, night, which happens often in restaurants, or, you know, you don't get too many customers that one shift, and your tips don't add up to the minimum wage, the employer is supposed to make up that difference. And yet, from what I've heard, I mean, I've talked to dozens of waiters, probably more than a dozen, and probably, you know, up to 100 waiters around, mainly in the city, and not a single one has mentioned ever having their employer make up that gap, make up that difference. Like, it's a real, like, kind of hidden crisis, which we don't really touch on in this ProPublica story, but I'd like to kind of, you know, to report out in a different story, is that that tip differential, they call it, is almost never paid by the employer, from what I hear from dozens of waiters and busboys.
And so for those people, whether or not they're undocumented, whether or not they're documented, whether they're low income, maybe they're not aware of what these rules are, even though they're supposed to be posted in any of these businesses, what can they do?
Well, one thing they can do is they can obviously go to the Department of Labor and file a wage theft claim, which is, you know, what we discussed in the story, that can have mixed results. I mean, on the one hand, the Department of Labor's, you know, wage theft enforcement division is full of hardworking professionals. They are dedicated to their mission, and they're underpaid, and they're, you know, they don't have enough investigators to do the work, but they fully investigate these cases. There's a formal process. And then at the end of it, they, when they substantiate the claim, they'll go to the employer and say, okay, you know, Gloria, you owe $10,000 to this person. And oftentimes the employer just will ignore it and just not do it. And then there are several steps that you can take. You can keep coming back at them. There can be judgments. But as we report, there's many cases where workers whose claims are substantiated don't get the back wages they're owed, which is heartbreaking because, I mean, these are mainly, like I said, low-income workers. They depend on this money to support their families, to buy groceries, to pay the rent, and all of a sudden, they're out. It really hurts. But, you know, it sometimes obviously does result in the, you know, payment of back wages. Another option is to obviously pursue litigation, which can be difficult because it can be expensive. I think often lawyers don't touch these cases because they're too small. You know, maybe you're owed $5,000 or $2,000, and that's just too small a case for a lawyer to pick up. And other times you go directly to the employer, and if you have the, you know, the security, job security, or the financial security to do that, which many don't, and to try to make a settlement of your own with your boss, which is rare. So it's a very difficult situation, I think, especially for workers in, who are vulnerable, like undocumented workers, working in certain sectors where they could easily be fired and replaced with somebody else. There's even retaliation where workers have complained about wage theft and they are threatened or actually physically assaulted, as is documented in our latest story written by Max Siegelbaum from Documented this morning on ProPublica, my colleague. That's happened. So it's very difficult. But the Department of Labor is sort of the principal place that people can go to for complaining about wage theft.
And so what about class actions? Is there any way in which There could be some type of class action on behalf. And does the Department of Labor actually bring any cases, or does it just investigate and have the administrative side?
I mean, in general, once you go to the Department of Labor, you're sort of precluded from pursuing a lawsuit. So, but the Department of Labor, they'll take over the case. And in cases where it's egregious or it involves such a large class of workers, they might take it to the Attorney General's office or to the DA, to so one of the local DAs in that region, to pursue. But the prosecutors have very small staffs that deal with wage theft cases, so they only take on a few cases. And you do see them when that happens. There's obviously indictments, people go to jail, it makes the headlines, but they're kind of few and far between. So in general, in terms of a class action, it can be difficult because you have to convince, if you are a victim of wage theft and you know that your coworkers are also being cheated out of their wages, you have to convince them to join you, which can be very risky, in going to a lawyer and bringing a case. But there are numerous class action suits. I mean, I'm doing some other research for another story we're doing about this wage theft crisis, and it involves a lot of class action suits from employees at big companies where there might be, dozens or even hundreds of workers who've all been cheated, and they come together to pursue a class action suit. And that's obviously a whole separate track from the Department of Labor path.
Well, I hope you also have the opportunity at ProPublica to investigate the power of the union, because I've been looking and talking with, yes, many people who are bringing together gig workers and other workers who are low-income wage earners to form their own unions so that they could speak with a stronger voice and have more to push back against when it comes to employers who are deciding to cheat them out of their money. Have you looked at this at all?
I mean, not specifically. I just know that there, I mean, unions obviously are a very important resource for, like, in the construction industry. Unions have been very forceful at getting better wages for workers and fighting, to when there's cases of wage theft, the unions are right away at the front lines, pushing for those workers to be paid the back wages plus penalties. So, when there are unions involved, there tends to be much less wage theft. In terms of the gig economy, it's obviously, very difficult, and there are these new unions that are forming to organize those workers. And that, I think, is a very positive thing in general for workers because it shows that they have a strong ally who will fight with them. I mean, you can imagine it's very difficult if you're a delivery driver for, a restaurant in Bushwick, and you've been cheated out of your wages for years and years, and you're by yourself, and perhaps you're undocumented. You're very unlikely to pursue a wage theft claim because you're worried about losing your job, number one, being retaliated against, perhaps, facing other consequences that are more even severe, especially if you're undocumented. So a union can be a very powerful ally in these cases.
I want to just end with these last two questions. One, where are you going next with this? Is there another part of the story you're investigating as well?
Yeah, I mean, next we're going to start pursuing, first of all, looking at some of the larger wage theft violators in the state. There are some wage theft violators that have literally stolen millions of dollars from their employees and have not paid the back wages. And some of these are household names. Some of these are your, favorite local restaurant. Some of them are, major companies, major employers in the city. Some of them are big government contractors for the state. Delving more into who these companies are and how they can get away with, with not paying these back wages and not facing consequences. And then other stories, we're going to look at some of the sectors of the New York economy where wage theft is pervasive. For example, nail salons, which obviously had a big scandal, you know, 6-7 years ago regarding how workers are treated. Nail salon workers are still underpaid in many cases. The same thing with home health care workers who have to work often, you know, 36-hour shifts and are supposed to be given meal breaks and sleep breaks, but that doesn't often happen, which means that they end up getting paid less than minimum wage. That's a big problem. So we're looking at certain sectors of the economy where wage theft is still pervasive and not much is being done to help these workers. So.
Well, I thank you. And once again, in your research, what's the best thing for a person to do, if you can give us just maybe two in these last moments, two things that they can do when they find out that they've been cheated out of their wages?
I would say number one is try to document what's happening as much as possible. Like anything written down, obviously, is key. Even a promise that's written down in a piece of paper from your boss telling you what you should be paid, or you know, some sort of documentation that shows how you're being underpaid, what you're actually being paid versus what you should be paid. And it is a violation of labor law to not post salary information at the workplace, and many places don't do that. So that's something. And then if there are worker advocacy organizations in your specific industry sector, whether it's construction or restaurants, go to them. There are, you know, plenty of excellent groups out there that pursue this type of advocacy work and can give you advice confidentially and help you prepare a wage theft claim. And then it definitely is worth, you know, going to the Department of Labor and filing a wage theft claim and just being persistent, like really working with them through their investigation so they can do it as quickly as possible, and being on top of them to pressure them to finalize and helping them with the information they need to go after the employer. Because oftentimes in these cases, employers are able to get away with it because they take steps like changing their name, closing temporarily and reopening in another borough, switching ownership from, you know, wife to husband to cousin. So there are very sneaky ways that employers try to avoid responsibility. And the more documentation that the Department of Labor has, the easier it is for them to investigate these cases and to recover the money that is owed to the workers. And in some cases, if it's really, it seems impossible to make headway through government channels, obviously there's litigation that you can pursue. Although that, like I said, that can come with its own risks, whether it's, you know, involving expense or also a long waiting period. You know, sometimes this litigation can take years. So it's, yeah, it can be very difficult, but it's good to work with the worker advocacy organizations who can really be a strong ally to workers in these cases.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Marcus Baram. He's the recipient of the McGraw Fellowship for Business Journalism, a reporter at ProPublica, and the author of the 2014 biography of the late Gil Scott Heron, Pieces of a Man. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you can come back when you complete your other investigations.
I'd love to, definitely. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for your interest in the story.
Thank you. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. I also want you to know that you can file that complaint. You can call if you believe that you are a victim of wage theft or you know someone who is. You can call the New York State Department of Labor, and that number is 888-469-7365. Once again, 888-469-7365. 7365. This is on the internet. Use that phone for more than sending text messages, looking up nonsense, and making telephone calls. Use your phone that you have or any other internet device, and you can look up here how to file a complaint with the Department of Labor and also find this number. And if you missed anything that was said today by our guest, the show is archived, so you can go to the show, listen to it again, or you can go to my podcast, Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and listen to the program again. I want you to be empowered and enlightened. I want you to use Law of the Land as part of what you can use in your day-to-day life to feel that you're not here alone, and also that you have some tools in your toolkit to make your life better and make the lives of other people better. I want to talk to you with the time we have left about the argument that was made about Donald Trump, who has been, of course, given $200,000 that they say, what is $200,000 to him? But $200,000 for him to agree to show up again in court. And that's $200,000. And that's the Georgia case. He has four other cases and probably even more than that. That Georgia case in which he has been accused of tampering with an election. And he wants the trial to take place in 2026 as opposed to 2024. That's one part of it. And I'm not going into that right now. There's going to be enough time for us to go into all these different machinations of Donald Trump. What I want to go to is the legal issue that was put forward, whether or not he is precluded from running for president because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Now, this is something I'm going to do as succinctly as I possibly can. We can come back to it again, but I want you to know that when the Constitution, the provision of 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, it was done so post-Civil War, in order to give back to the African Americans what had been taken away by the Dred Scott decision. So the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, except as punishment for a crime. The 14th Amendment gives citizenship at birth, as well as privileges and immunities, due process, and equal protection. That's the first section. The second section I'm going to go into a little later in another show, but the third section is the one that was raised, whether or not after the Civil War, which was considered an insurrection and rebellion, that's what the Civil War was called in the Constitution. So when you see insurrection or rebellion in the 14th Amendment, that's what they're referring to, the Civil War. But now there's been an argument made that since Donald Trump instigated the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, whether or not that constitutes a rebellion or insurrection, and therefore the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment precludes him from running for office, because it states in Section 3, no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same. So what it's saying is anybody who was in the federal government, in the state government, in the military, anyone who was a judge at that time, any office whatsoever, where you had to swear to uphold the Constitution. And there are many jobs. When I was a law clerk in federal court, I had to swear to uphold the Constitution. There are many jobs. Police officers, for example, swear to uphold the Constitution. So I want to make sure we understand, even though this is a focus of whether or not Donald Trump should be able to run for president of the United States, because it says no person shall be able to do this if they participated in a rebellion or insurrection against the country. That also means those police officers, those firefighters, all of those government employees, anybody in the military who also participated in the insurrection against the Capitol should be denied their positions in their workplaces, because it says if they participated in this act, then they are not allowed to be in these jobs again. So I want this to be a focus about Donald Trump, but also extend the focus to anyone who participated in that insurrection and rebellion against the Capitol to stop Joe Biden from becoming president, would also be unable to continue in their workplaces. I want us to think about that. That is something that has not been stated. And that, you know, I try to bring you the cutting edge of what's on my mind, my thought process. This is one of them. So keep that in mind. I want us to also, as we go forward, know that WBAI needs your assistance in order for me to be here to give you this information. Information, for example, the cutting edge, Marcus Baram, this story is in the New York Times today, hot off the presses about wage theft. It was not there yesterday. It came out this morning. And you were on the cutting edge to hear from one of the researchers, investigative reporters who works on this story on WBAI, hot off the presses. I want to keep you on the cutting edge. That is part of my job, is to do this. And I'm a member of the NASA Association of Black Journalists. I'm a member of Society of Professional Journalists. I am also, as you know, someone who writes books, who is trying to gain all of this knowledge to provide it to you here on Law of the Land. In order for me to do that, I need to ask you to support WBAI, support our show. I need you to become a WBAI buddy. Become a WBAI buddy. And this is crucial at this point because there are so many things that need to be done. The lights need to be paid and the electricity needs to be on. So many things need to take place in order for us to do this show. And if you would just become a WBAI buddy, and it doesn't take that much, if you can spare it. And I know you're tired of us asking you for money all the time. I know I would be tired of it too, but I need you to assist us in this way, in very small ways, if possible, in becoming a BAI buddy, and let us know that you care about the information that we're putting forward. If somebody you know can actually benefit from this story on wage theft, think about that. Think about the benefit that that's going to give to you and so many other people, because now you know. We've given you the number, we've given you the information that you can go on and find out more about how to actually bring an action to stop people from continuing to steal from the little guy, the little gal, the person who's working, you know, three jobs in order to try to make ends meet. So I would really just appreciate it if you could do it. And if you become a BAI buddy, you'll be a part of a group that's been around for quite some time and a group that continues to keep our station running strong. If you could, I would also want to make a very short announcement. You know, my book is She Took Justice, The Black Woman, Law and Power. And if you decide that you're going to give, then think about giving in a way that you can get my book, She Took Justice, The Black Woman, Law and Power, and I will sign it for you and get it back to you. So think about that. And if you can, my plays are online. They've been here on BAI, not just Shot Caught a Soul, which is one of my plays that you can see if you go online. Just look for Shot Caught a Soul, shot, and put my name in it, and you'll find it. But if you would also look for Dreams of Emmett Till, you can see these things. WBAI has had these programs on. My plays have played on WBAI Theater on the Radio. So all of this is here for us to to learn from, to become better, to be empowered by. That's a better way of doing it, to and also to make you feel not alone in the world, that there are people out here who are trying to make things better. When you're looking around, and I know it's frustrating to say, where are we going? What's going on in this world? You're not the only one feeling that way. We're all trying to do the best we can. But I would also say, please keep in mind that in order for us to do this, we need your assistance. And that means being a part of BAI through giving the best you can when you can. That's what we're trying to do on our side. Do the best we can when we can. So if you can give, give to WBAI, give to the number 2, WBAI, 209-2950, 212-209-2950. And if you can give, it would be great, 212-209-2950. Just to give to WBAI and give in a way that is up to you to help this station continue on its path. Things are a little rocky. You can make it less so, given what you can. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Become a BAI buddy. I like the t-shirt. Get the t-shirt. We can get our t-shirts together. Maybe we can get together with the t-shirts. But either way, I want us to make sure that we stay well. And that means feeling healthy inside so that you know that the world is not bigger than you if you're coming together as a community. 212-209-2950. Let's come together as a community on WBAI. I'm going to let you go with that. Coming up soon, you'll be able to give as much as you can, when you can. But on Law of the Land, we just want you to be healthy inside and out. And with that, I'll say, I'll see you, one and all. You too.
How you know how I feel.
On the radio.